Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Our next guest has written an immersive look at justice in America, told through the interwoven lives of condemned prisoners and the men and women who come to visit them. In 2018, after nearly a decade's hiatus, the state of Tennessee began executing death row inmates, bucking national trends that showed the death penalty in decline. In less than 2 years, the state put 7 men to death, more than any other state but Texas in that time period. It was an execution spree unlike any seen in Tennessee since the 1940s, one only brought to a halt by a global pandemic. Journalist Stephen Hale was the leading reporter on these executions, covering them both locally for the Nashville Scene Alt Weekly and nationally for The Appeal. In the new book, Death Row Welcomes You, Hale traces the lives of condemned prisoners at the Riverbend Maximum Security Institution and the people who come to visit them, what brought them, the visitors and convicted murderers alike, to death row, a question he answers in the new book. It's a great pleasure to welcome Stephen Hale to this morning's roundtable. Stephen, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it having you here.
Thanks so much for having me, Joe. I really appreciate it.
Really nice to talk to you, especially after reading this. I'm curious as to, this was a beat for you, but how did you gravitate toward it as a subject of something you wanted to cover?
Yeah, I mean, I had had an interest in the death penalty as I, you know, became an adult. A few experiences. I mentioned early in the introduction to the book that just after I got out of college, the execution of Troy Davis in Georgia, I kind of stumbled upon the coverage of that one night and became very kind of captivated by that. He was a man who had claimed his innocence, and there was a lot of coverage around that. And then once I became a working journalist here in Nashville, Tennessee, I started covering criminal justice and various parts of the system. And it was around 2014, 2015, when the state started indicating they were going to start scheduling executions, and actually did schedule one. And I started reporting on that case. Those executions ended up getting canceled because there was some litigation over the lethal injection process in Tennessee. But at that point, I had kind of gotten pulled into reporting on those cases, reporting on the death penalty process. And so when it came back around in 2018, I really got into it more deeply.
Bring us to the facility in Tennessee and where that fits in the overall numbers that we were talking about of the number of executions.
Death Row, Tennessee's Death Row is housed at Riverbend Maximum Security Institution just outside of Nashville. It's maybe 15 minutes from downtown Nashville. And they're, that's also where they carry out the executions. And so early in 2018, when they started scheduling these executions, I applied to be a witness, a media witness for the first one. And, you know, as I was preparing to cover that and reporting on the case of that man, it was a man named Billy Ray Eyrick, I started trying to figure out a way to get in touch with the men on death row so that I might be able to interview them. Media access to the prisons here, but especially to death row inmates, is very restricted. And so, but I wanted to be able to give them a chance to comment, you know, as their executions were approaching, or a chance to say anything or to answer some questions. And in my attempts to reach out to them and get in touch with them, I ended up meeting some people who told me, to my surprise, that they regularly visited death row. And what I learned was that Tennessee's death row is pretty unique in terms of death rows around the country, which is that the death row inmates here have they can earn, basically through good behavior, a lot of privileges to be out of their cell, to do arts and crafts, and also to have contact visits, to have visits where they're not shackled and they're not behind a window and they can sit in an open room and visit with people. And So as these executions were approaching and then as they were being carried out, I kind of got to know that community. And yeah, so over the course of around 2 years, 7 men were executed. And while that was happening, I was getting to know these men and women who visit the guys on death row here, and as members of their community were being put to death.
You mentioned 2018, and you applied for this to be a media witness, but it was basically a lottery, right?
That's right.
To be in the room when it happened. How did you feel? You write about it, obviously, and it's very strong and blistering as to what you witnessed. But were you ready for it?
You know, I guess in hindsight, I don't know if I was, and I don't know if I could have been. I felt strongly about doing it because I did, or at least volunteering to do it, because I did feel and still do feel that it's you know, as journalists, the whole job in a way is to bear witness to things and then report on them. And sometimes those things are higher stakes than others, you know, but I thought in particular when the state is going to kill one of its citizens, that the very least they should do is let representatives of the people, you know, watch them do that and see how it's done and see if it's done the way the state says it's going to be done and then report what happens. And so that if we have this process in this country, that we at least are looking at it square in the face and seeing what it is. And so I felt strongly about that sort of as a principle. And so that kind of made me volunteer to do it without really much of a second thought. I think, you know, after the fact, I was less naive about it and about how, you know, maybe what it was going to be like. I did have the chance to talk to some other journalists who had been through that experience and kind of try to prepare for it that way. But yeah, it was certainly not easy. And I was not alone. Of course, there are other media witnesses there with me, as for all the other executions who do this work. And so that helped too, I think. You know, we went in there together as kind of a pool of journalists to cover this this important event. And I think that helped me get through. I think the fact that I had a job to do did help me get through it in the moment, you know.
The state of Tennessee has conducted more than 500 legal executions since it became a state, and with many in the 30s and 40s. But from 1961 to 2000, Tennessee did not carry out a single execution. What changed, and what changed in Tennessee that while there were other states that continued many also, a fairly large number, right? 23 states in the District of Columbia that have outlawed the death penalty.
That's right. I mean, I think there's a number of factors. Part of what changed, just one of those factors is for quite a while the state of Tennessee had, and I outlined this in the book, kind of the history of executions in Tennessee, but had gone from hanging to the electric chair. And then there was, as you say, a long period where there were no executions. And then, you know, the adoption of lethal injection is a piece of this, where there was this new method that was seen as possibly more humane or more palatable. And so some executions start getting scheduled. It's still not a lot. I think another part of it is just politically the leaders in some states, including Tennessee, whether it's governors, attorneys general, but also state Supreme Court justices who were more inclined to schedule these executions to sign off on them. And then what has always, in more recent history here in Tennessee, what has been a constant variable is the legal kind of fight over the methods of execution and whether they are constitutional. So right now, Tennessee has two methods, the lethal injection and the electric chair, and there has been litigation over both of those, whether they constitute cruel and unusual punishment. The electric chair obviously is more of a stable thing. We all know what it is. It's electrocution. And so there has been some litigation over that. But lethal injection has been a moving target in a way because there are different drugs used by different states to execute people by lethal injection. During the time I cover in the book, state of Tennessee was using a three-drug, what's kind of known as a three-drug cocktail for its lethal injection. And so there was litigation over that and what the effects of the different drugs were. Some states use one drug, and then another factor layered on top of that is that the states have had an increasingly difficult time obtaining these drugs because a lot of pharmaceutical companies have over the years been under pressure not to allow their drugs to be used in executions, and some of them have stopped that. And so it's become more and more difficult for states to get drugs, which has then raised more legal questions. And so a lot of the litigation is the reason why you see these stretches of time where there's no executions, and then there will be some, and then there may be new legal challenges that hold them for a while. And so that's what's going on actually right now in Tennessee. We're in a period where there's been a few years without an execution because the lethal injection protocol was under review, and the state was kind of trying to determine how to move forward.
Not to get us off the subject, but just your opinion and your thought of what's happening in Alabama, of the use of nitrogen gas, and one man has been executed, and a second is scheduled to be. Right? Is that from my
understanding? That's right.
So what you make of that, a very controversial method and one that I think only two other states have it in their arsenal?
Yeah, it's a complicated thing. I mean, I think a lot of people have a sort of visceral reaction to that for quite obvious reasons. One being that the idea of gassing people or a person to death is an echo of some of the worst atrocities in our history, obviously. And so whenever you hear of that happening, that I think that conjures that in people's mind in a way that's understandable. Also, though, I think it brings up this central tension about the death penalty, which is that we are kind of constantly going back and forth about how to carry this out, the methods. You know, do we hang people? Do we lethally inject them? Do we electrocute them? Do we use a firing squad? And a lot of people understandably ask, why is this so complicated? I mean, I've had people respond to my writing here in Tennessee by saying, you know, perhaps rather crassly, but understandably saying, well, why not just shoot these people? I mean, there are easy ways to kill people. You know, we can all imagine a pretty quick way to kill someone. And I think there are a lot of answers for that. One is, of course, that there are constitutional protections against cruel and unusual punishment. And so certain things are deemed cruel and unusual, and the courts have various ways that they've decided that. Sometimes it's because this is not a method that's being used anywhere else, and so that's unusual. Sometimes it's because it would cause torture or an excessive amount of pain that the court deems cruel. But the other thing is that I think I don't want to be too presumptuous about how other people feel about this, but I do get a sense that we have a certain discomfort about this that we sometimes don't own up to. And it seems to me that we have often been in the search for a way to execute people that doesn't quite seem like an execution or doesn't quite appear like killing someone. And I think that that's a bit of a folly. Having witnessed executions myself, now I can tell you, I mean, I've witnessed a lethal injection and an electrocution. I haven't witnessed every method, but that's two of them. And both of them looked very much like killing a person, you know. And I think even the ones that are supposed to look sort of peaceful and, you know, and you mentioned the gas, the idea there, of course, is that, well, this person will wear a mask and they will kind of just pass out. The reports from that execution indicated that it was not that simple. And I think that, so I think almost, you know, whether it's kind of psychologically or just culturally, I think we do have a kind of weird relationship with this, where we as a country, at least in many states, are still carrying out executions, or at least legally willing to, but that we also have this weird relationship with how we do it. And I think that raises some real fundamental questions about whether we are okay with doing this and whether we should be.
Stephen Hale is our guest. The name of the book is Death Row Welcomed You. So much of the book is about this group of people that visited the prisons on most Mondays and spent time with those on death row. You refer to it in the book as a fellowship of the living and the condemned. How so?
Yeah, I mean, the guys on death row, and I say guys, but in Tennessee we only have one woman on death row, and she is incarcerated at a different facility. So in the context of the book, these are all men that are on death row. They, for societally, in a way, they are already dead. You know, they are kept away. We don't see them very often. We don't hear of them unless an execution is approaching, usually in the news. So they are kind of living in this other world, this other dimension almost. And the people from the outside world, in this instance in Tennessee, have started going into that other world and starting to spend time with them there. And so there's this weird sense in which it was this community that was kind of crossing a border between the land of the condemned and the land of the living, if you will. And it was a very profoundly moving and powerful thing to witness and get to be a part of, because on the one hand, you know, if you go visit someone on death row, you're sitting with someone who, on the one hand, you have nothing in common with.
Right.
You know, their lives look nothing like yours day to day, in the sense that they are in a very small cell. They will never leave there, most likely. They are living with the knowledge that at any point their name will be put on a calendar and next to a date where they will be executed. Their meals are different. Their access to information, everything about their life is different. On the other hand, once you're sitting down with someone, you know, face to face in real life and talking to them, a lot of those differences do kind of disappear in some ways. I mean, people I interviewed for the book who are the regular visitors, and then also in my own experience, you can forget where you are, as weird as that sounds to say, when you're at the visitation gallery here in Riverbend and you are visiting someone and, you know, often sharing a snack, some popcorn and drinking water out of a small cup, you know, over the course of an hour or two, you can kind of begin to be lulled into this sense that you're just sitting in a room having a conversation with another person. And then that is all shattered, of course, once you leave and walk back out through the prison, through the barbed wire and the gates and all that. But it is this sense of kind of all of that falling away, and it's very hard to shake once you've had that experience.
You write a beautiful sentence in the book that the weekly gatherings are so ordinary as to be extraordinary, and so life-giving as to feel defiant.
Yes, I think there's something, I don't know about you, but I mean, I think in my own experience and for many people that I've talked to, when they imagine, if you just tell them you're going to go see someone on death row, what they have in their head is very likely something closer to Hannibal Lecter, you know,
right,
being wheeled out or restrained or something. And to be clear, I mean, a lot of the death rows in America, the experience is more like that, in the sense that the men on death row are kept in their cell almost constantly and restrained and things like that. But in this experience and in the way it's working right now in Tennessee, yeah, it was something so different from that. And like I said, so ordinary that actually is what is so strange about it and what's so extraordinary about it. And as far as it feeling defiant, you know, a lot of the folks here that I got to know who are regular visitors of death row inmates would not consider themselves to be activists, you know, so much. I mean, at least at the beginning, they did not start going out there because they wanted to fight the death penalty. A lot of them, through a church, say, or some other community group, got we're told that they, you know, this might be a good thing for you to do, go visit some men in prison and provide them some kind of, dialogue and relationship. And then they got to know these people and they became invested in it themselves. And, you know, I think that these gatherings and these relationships that are formed there almost are themselves a kind of protest, because they sort of do defy what we're told that the death penalty is all about, which is that these men, these condemned prisoners, are irredeemable, that you know, we cannot have a society that still includes them. And but if you go sit in a room with a dozen of them and a dozen other outside people who are just visitors, you will see that apparently is not quite the case.
And what you do so beautifully in the book is you certainly do not take away from the atrocities and the horrible things that these men are accused and have been convicted of, but also talking about them as people who are that you're having a discussion with, which is obviously a delicate balance.
Yeah, and I think I appreciate you saying that. I did not want in any way to diminish or dismiss the very real horrible crimes that many of these men committed. And in my experience, you know, there's a couple cases in the book where there are innocence claims and questions about guilt. But in many of them, the people are very honest about their guilt. You know, they're saying, yeah, I did do this. And so, you know, I think, to me, the goal was to just look at it all as clearly as I could, and hopefully for readers to see it as clearly as I could, and for us to just say, okay, here's what this person did, here's who they are now, and here's what it means to execute them. And, you know, people can sort of make up their minds how they feel about all that, but I think both my sort of obligation as a journalist, but also just as a person, what I wanted was to just try to see it all clearly and try to hold it all at once and figure out, what do I do with that? You know, what do you do with the fact that someone could be, a murderer, right, but could, you know, there's a man in the book who is a central figure named Terry King, who I've gotten to know and become close with. And, you know, he murdered a woman and was a participant in the murder of a young man, 40 some years ago. And has also made, carved out of wood, a birdhouse with my daughter's names on it. And one of those does not undo the other, you know, that doesn't excuse his past crime or sort of diminish how horrible it was. But it is a complicating factor, and I think a context that I hope we can all just look at square in the face and say, what do we think about this, you know, that the same person is capable of both of these things.
Stephen Hale is a journalist and author of the new book, Death Row Welcomes You, Visiting Hours in the Shadow of the Execution Chamber. The book is published by Melville House. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for telling the story and for writing the book. Congratulations.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me on. It's an honor to chat with you.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, Stephen Hale's book is Death Row Welcomes You. It's published by Melville House. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.